Hello, folks, and welcome to the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. I am your host, Dr. Shadi Nabhan. I'm the chairman of the Precision Oncology Alliance, our large collaborative research network at Caris Life Sciences that combines many academic institutions, healthcare systems, community practices, cooperative groups. All of us are working on research to advance the science and to help improve the outcomes of all patients diagnosed with cancer. I appreciate you tuning in. I appreciate your support to the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. And if you are listening, make sure you check out the podcast everywhere you consume podcasts, rate it, subscribe to it, share it with your friends and colleagues, and let me know how we can improve on the topics. I mean, they are perfect, but there's always an opportunity for improvement. But don't forget to let me know by emailing me at cnabhan@carisls.com. Today's podcast is about pathogens and cancer. I am interviewing Dr. Emil Liu, associate professor from the University of Minnesota, and he is currently the chair of our newly created Pathogens and Cancer Working Group within the Precision Oncology Alliance. A lot has been said about the association between certain pathogens and cancer. Now, this may not apply to all cancers, but for certain cancers, I mean, there are many examples out there. HPV, human papillomavirus, is a perfect example that we know about the association with cervical cancers and so on. The question is, what do we do about this information? What are the research implications? What are the clinical implications? And what does the future hold? And to answer this, Dr. Emil Liu is joining me on the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. This is a podcast that you don't want to miss. If you're listening, you clearly are not missing it, which is perfect. But make sure you share it with your friends and colleagues. Without further ado, Dr. Emil Liu on the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. All right. Well, here we are with Dr. Emil Liu on the Caris Molecular Minute Podcast. Always pleasure to see you, Emil, on this platform, and always a pleasure to connect with you. But for folks who are listening who may not know you, which would be a problem, by the way, if there's somebody who is listening to this show who does not know you, they'll have to talk to me about that. But tell us a little bit about you and where you are, where you practice, and how in the world did you end up becoming a GI oncologist? And I heard a rumor about a neuro-oncology as well.
Yeah, no, all of it, rumors that I can substantiate. So hello, hello everybody. Hello, Chatty. It's always my privilege to come on with you, and always a lot of fun. And we always learn a lot together, right, throughout the years. So I'm Dr. Emil Liu. I'm a medical oncologist, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center trained, and Duke University as well. And I've been at the University of Minnesota since 2011. I primarily practice clinically gastrointestinal cancer. And so, you know, I kind of tell the story that as a fellow at Memorial Sloan Kettering, I was embedded or like majored in, so to speak, in thoracic oncology. And then I ended up doing an extra brain tumor neuro-oncology fellowship at the Duke Brain Tumor Center the year after that. Of course, it makes perfect sense. I've carved out my clinical niche in GI oncology for more than the past decade. So partly out of need and partly out of interest, I had a great experience with some of the masters of GI oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering through my training. And so it very much appealed to me, the diversity, colorectal, pancreas, you know, and the other, especially kind of rare tumors of interest, appendix and neuroendocrine tumors in particular are also of interest. So it just, it provides never a dull moment. It provides fertile opportunity for research, including, you know, working with you at Caris and the whole team to explore genomic differences between these cancers, what predicts what will drive these cancers to be more aggressive in some patients more than others, or potentially response to novel therapies, including immunotherapy and maybe cellular therapies in the future, and a lot of different things. So I have a lab. We do basic cancer cell biology, and a lot of the translational research is really geared towards how can we help human patients and uncover the next biomarkers or something that can be substantiated and validated further in larger trial settings.
And it's really, I mean, you're able to balance this clinical and lab, which what we have obviously called over the years translational work. And it's really amazing because, you know, we all know how stressful it is, frankly, to run a lab with funding and everything going on. How do you divide your time? I mean, how much do you spend time in the lab versus clinic versus administrative responsibilities?
Yeah. So going back to that theme of never a dull moment. So every day is action packed, and On the days twice a week, I see patients in our outpatient clinic, and then I have some inpatient responsibilities throughout the year. So it's approximately a quarter of my time with direct patient care, and of course, in between, addressing patient issues with the clinic staff. And then much of the majority of my time, if it's not administrative in nature, is spent working with my lab team. I have a wonderful lab team, and we meet twice a week for certain. And then sometimes I just pop in the lab randomly to see what's going on and really just help at the any project at all stages. We have things literally at the microscope, and then more translational projects that include assessment of big data. So any given day of the week, I'm working on either a manuscript or a grant or both, even on the same day, the same week. And so just trying to move a lot of different players in the race at all times,
and you always
all in
have,
name of progress.
And you always have time to tweet, and you have a very interesting handle, at Cancer Assassin. I mean, I don't know how you got this early on in the I think you can sell that in the future. Trust me.
Yeah. When it comes time for retirement and done for my tweeting days, the auction will open. So yeah. On the highest bid.
So I asked you to come on the show, Emil, to talk about pathogens and cancer. And I'm going to share with you a story that when I was, I think I was still a junior faculty many years back. And, as you know, there's a form of lymphoma, maltoma, that is mainly associated or caused by H. pylori. Mm-hmm. And, the first line of therapy for this type of lymphoma is actually H. pylori therapy and all that stuff. So without going into much details, I recall talking to one of the ID attendings that I was working with, and he would joke with me. He's like, Chadi, I told you, cancer is an infectious disease. You guys need us. Cancer is an infectious disease. And 20 years later, I still think about this because now there's a lot of emerging evidence about, the association between cancer and certain bacteria or viruses. So we want to talk about that. First of all, cancer broadly, without any specific type of cancer, why would you even think that any pathogen could cause cancer? Like where did this come from?
Yeah. I'm glad you're mentioning this theme because a lot of old things are made new again. So my PhD, when I was a quarter century ago, a poor starving graduate student, my PhD came out of the microbiology and immunology sphere. I was working on oncolytic viruses, and that was another idea that had been around for 100 years, yet the technology had to catch up. And then even subsequent to the time I was in the lab where it was a hot topic, it went away. And then it's come back in a fierce way from a therapeutic standpoint. Last 5-6 years to the point where we can treat patients with metastatic melanoma with this type of technology. From a causative end, I think you hit the nail on the head. It's more than a century, 150 years even, where people speculated these abnormal masses that grow, what infections might have to do with that. It's something that I think has not been central to our understanding, especially in recent years with the rise of molecular oncology, so molecular focused. I think cellular causes of cancer have been more recognized in recent years. I think hand in hand with that, not separate, but combined with that is this issue of pathogens. So we've known for decades that a few pathogens can cause as many as 20% of all cancers. So H. pylori, for which Dr. Barry Marshall won the Nobel Prize for discovery of relating. And as you said, the malt lymphoma, how remarkable it is that we don't have to pound that cancer or treat or subject a patient with that cancer to all kinds of potentially toxic chemotherapies, but rather treat the underlying cause, which is the pathogen, which is a bacteria.
By the way, that's an amazing stat that you mentioned. 20% of all cancers are caused by pathogens.
Mm-hmm. And I think I won't doubt in the next decade, if we have this conversation again, which I hope we do in the coming years, that number will probably rise out of better recognition, being able to better detect. But the flip side, Chadi, conversely, is how many people have infections that we know can be associated. So, for example, the herpes virus family, right, is composed of many different types of infections, and so HSV-1 and 2, and also Epstein-Barr virus, which is more known to be the cause of mononucleosis, and people can get it as teenagers or adults, but more than 80% or even say maybe even more than 90% of the population worldwide and in the US has antibodies against these viruses. So we've all been exposed, whether in childhood and in daycare or growing up, and at some point we've been exposed. But how many of those people who have been exposed have had cancer? Well, not all of them, certainly not 90%, 80% of the worldwide population. So there's really definitely some number of factors that are going, but I'm struck by when patients ask me, well, why did I get cancer at any age, whether it's a young adult or someone who's older, even though we refer to cancer as a disease of aging, I always kind of quote, well, the likelihood of it being hereditary is under 5 to 10%. All the rest, 95%, hereditary. They ask me environmental. So what environmental? So I'll talk about tobacco, I'll talk about alcohol, and I'll talk about being sedentary and not active. And then at that point, I say, the rest we just don't know. And that part of what we just don't know, I think at least in part, could be explained once we gain more knowledge about the role of pathogens in cancer beyond what we already know, and how can we target and undercut the cancers that are driven by pathogens.
You need to mention pesticides for certain cancers.
And pesticides, yes. Yeah.
That's really interesting. And today, though, we're obviously taping this in 2023. Today, there are certain cancers with clear causation and association with certain pathogens. And obviously, there continues to be investigations about the other cancers that we just don't know. Mm-hmm. So for our listeners, what type of cancers we know for sure that there is a relationship between the cancer and the actual pathogen, whatever that pathogen is, whether it's a bacteria, a virus, I don't know if fungi is associated or parasites, but that's obviously what we would like to talk about.
Yeah. So since you mentioned parasites and also other viruses, for example, known, liver cancer comes to mind readily. So it's, you know, it's worldwide, and there are different pockets of endemic causes that are pathogen related. So, you know, I think it's something we learned in second year medical school of pathology, but it's also very true. For example, schistosomiasis, an endemic parasite in Africa, has been linked to liver fluke infection and hepatocellular carcinoma. Endemic to many parts of Asia is hepatitis B and hepatitis C that is vertically transmitted through generations, but also horizontal transmission. And hepatitis B and hepatitis C are classic. And so in terms of cause and effect and strong associations, we know that not everybody with liver cancer has those, but we have to think of those when making a diagnosis, but also work, for example, as a GI oncologist who helps patients with liver cancer, working closely with hepatologists or gastroenterology specialists, or the hepatitis B or hepatitis C infections that are likely chronic over years and induce pathogenic changes, molecular and cellular level, causing the cancer. Are those infections treatable? What is the benefit of treating those concurrently? I think there's been more data that it's not enough to just treat the cancer, but the hepatitis B and hepatitis C that very likely cause the cancer, we have to address that issue too.
We're talking about hepatocellular carcinoma, right?
Yes, hepatocellular carcinoma, exactly.
And with vaccination, like people when they get vaccines, that hopefully prevents hepatocellular carcinoma?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I don't know relation of vaccination rates to vaccinated versus unvaccinated in terms of cancer incidence, but I know someone smarter than myself would in the epidemiology world is likely been working on that.
Yeah, and that might actually explain, because I always wonder, hepatocellular carcinoma, it's interesting because it is more prevalent in certain areas of the world outside of the U.S. versus the U.S. Obviously, it's still here. That's why the vaccination piece came to my mind, because people are way more vaccinated against Hep B and Hep C in the U.S. versus other countries. Right. So that's actually very interesting. What other cancers come to mind that you think listeners should be aware of in terms of their relationship to pathogens?
Yeah, no, since we're still on the viral vibe, human papillomavirus. So in different parts of the body. So definitely in the GYN world, cervical cancer, and it's one of the cancers that we have screening for, but whether it's be HPV 16 and 18 are the most common strains, but there are others as well. But talking about human papillomavirus broadly, not only has implication and causation for cervical cancers in many cases, especially if people have other risk factors. In addition, smoking is just one of many that can be a cofactor for cervical cancer diagnosis. Head and neck cancer, for oropharyngeal cancers, HPV infection is actually associated with a better prognosis, but maybe differential response to the treatments that are standard of care. Immunotherapy has been more incorporated to head and neck, and in cervical cancer, I think that field with checkpoint inhibition has been welcoming. So from a causation standpoint, HPV, hepatitis B and hepatitis C, Epstein-Barr virus, and then the bacterial family, H. pylori, of which is the most famous. And then you raise the issue of fungi. I think we're going to, with better next generation sequencing and other genomic profiling technologies, we might be able to detect fungus as a kind of the third subfamily of causes of cancer. There have been some interesting studies that I've seen just even in the last 6 months, they'd say that within tumors, being able to detect virus or even fungus, that there are some potential associations. I think that really remains to be explored. We don't have definitive causation links yet, but if that's for the case for colorectal and other cancers, well, that's something nuanced that we don't yet address or have any ability to address clinically. But if it's something we have to be able to detect these infections and figure out what impact this might have on treatment.
I mean, I think one of the things you mentioned that struck me also is that the rate of association between pathogens and cancer might increase because our ability to detect these pathogens go high. I mean, you're a scientist, you're in the lab, and you probably have way more appreciation than others in terms of the ability to detect things. Are we moving into a molecular way of identifying these pathogens, and how does that work?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think just like we think of comprehensive genomic profiling, we're thinking of molecular drivers and passenger mutations and different molecular pathways and so on within tumors, and then also with more advances in blood, non-tumor based detection. I think hand in hand with that technology can definitely be leveraged and harnessed to detect pathogens of all kinds, viral as well as fungus and bacteria. In a different way. So traditionally, the serology, when I was referring to 80 or 90% or more of the human race has basically been exposed to some of these herpes viridae family, but not necessarily had an infection that's manifested in the form of an infection, or very much a minority of those have actually had cancer potentially related to those infections. But a lot of this is based on IgG antibodies and serology, and it's less specific, and it's less. The information is able to tell you evidence of a past infection exposure, not current, and in no way, shape, or form something you can relate to someone when they're diagnosed with cancer. Whether it's in the bloodstream, checking genetic material related to pathogens, or inside the tumor, really, I think is a really fertile area of exploration. If you can look at actual tumors and detect pathogens, and then determine what genomic signatures might be aligned with that, I think that's a game changer. That's something that's it's going to open up a break open the field of cancer-related pathogen investigation, and then look at the microbiome has been bandied about for so many years, but what is it? It's everything and anything and nothing all at once. But how do you parse that into saying what are things that are causing cancer that can lead to better cancer screening if these pathogens are detected and have a high enough rate of translation to cancer cause or risk? And then at the other end of the spectrum, how is it impacting the therapy we give? Immunotherapy, immune checkpoint inhibition. And this emergence of the idea that microbiome can interfere the balance between the good, quote, healthy or good bacteria that normally resides in our body. And when there's an imbalance, how can that affect whether or not immune therapy or even maybe even targeted or immunotherapy or other cytotoxic chemotherapies work? We need predictive algorithms for that if these data are true.
Absolutely. What's also striking, Emil, is that when you look at the prevalence of certain bacteria or viruses in the world, or let's say in America, versus the rate of cancer, it makes you wonder, for example, there's something else in addition to the pathogen. Like while the pathogen maybe is causing this, but by itself, it may not be sufficient. You brought an example, EBV, right? And mononucleosis. Even H. pylori. I mean, H. pylori is not as common here as in other areas of the world, but it's not like you're going to see, over 90% of people in the US have IgG antibodies against EBV, but you're not going to see everybody developing the EBV-associated cancers. So as a scientist, do you think, is the pathogen the initial trigger and then you need something else in addition to it? Or can the pathogen by itself cause this? Because if by itself, I would think there are more cancers that we would see.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So, coming back to the idea of EBV, I think there are a lot of unknowns, but some examples we know is that there's a whole slew of molecular pathways that viral infection that is active, and some of the studies I'm going to qualify might be in vitro or very limited, not like absolutely ready for prime time as of yet, but can induce molecular pathway changes that are well known to occur in many cancers, like ARID1A or Wnt pathway or Hedgehog pathway, and so on. So you can identify a lot of things, and then it becomes non-specific enough where somehow we just don't know. I think in that herpes viridis viridae family is interesting because we could be exposed as children or young adults and maybe never get the infection. And then why do some people have periods, whether it's periods of stress or extreme cold or extreme anything in life, where the latent virus that resides there lifelong and the neural ganglion is triggered, and maybe get episodes of herpes oral sores, for example, or other manifestations of that. Why do some people get that and not? And so is it those times where the virus is triggered that can induce early cancerous changes? It's you know, this is where we need infectious disease specialists, virologists,
Hey,
bacteriologists, fungologists.
Are we ready to add the ID folks to the multidisciplinary tumor boards?
Oh my gosh, I think we're knocking
oh
on the
boy.
door. If they're willing to tolerate us and come join the discussion, and very well may be the case, you know, we'll have to talk about these cancers. We'll look at the two-dimensional radiographic scans and say, you know, what do the cultures come out with? And they'll tell us, and they'll tell us how to treat it. And we need their help and their expertise, right?
I have to
this
say,
may become a required rotation in oncology fellowship from now on.
Yeah, and you know, but I have to say, it just really underscores that ultimately, cancer continues to be a complex disease, but also continues to be probably the disease that most benefits from multidisciplinary approach and having everybody puts their brain together. And I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, right now you got the pathologist, the radiation oncologist, the medical oncologist, the surgical oncologist, and the geneticist, and all of this. And then, you know, we need to add the ID soon.
I think so. You know, not to open a can of worms, but let's open up a can of worms. In the past 3 years, I think we've all become infectious disease specialists to some degree or another, some more than others, some more self-proclaimed without letters after the name. But it's been an area where we all learned what can be the effects of, in this case, a virus, right? That causes a global pandemic, and it's been on everyone's minds for several years. A central question of active research, which is really important, is we've, quote, gotten through the pandemic, and then there's an issue of long COVID. And there have been many reports and more coming out about whether it be long-term fatigue or neurologic effects. And even SARS-CoV-2, I saw a paper the other day that showed that its effect on the liver can alter glucose metabolism. Well, so now it introduces in my mind the question of, we just said 20% of cancers are believed to be driven or at least associated with pathogens, many of which are viruses, some of which are bacteria. Could the SARS-CoV-2 linger? Could there be reservoirs? What implication this could be for cancer in any organ? I just cited liver as just one example, but inflammation in people who had severe inflammatory reaction that might mimic cytokine storm that you might see after bone marrow transplant, for example, that severe, where people were in intensive care. So if they survived that and they, or maybe it was at post-vaccination era, not as extreme an infection, it's maybe it's not over. Maybe it's a point where the effects, and we won't know this for years, right? We won't know until a decade from now. Will there be spikes in certain types of cancers more than others? So that's my attempt to stoke the fires of discussion for the day for this podcast is we know of many pathogens we're associating more with cancers and figuring out whether they drive it and detecting it. And, you know, SARS-CoV-2 may have to add to that list in the future. We'll all find out.
Lots of exciting times and a really interesting topic that we all need to keep our eyes on and continue the investigation and research. Emil, thank you so much for spending some time with the Caris Molecular Minute podcast today. I really appreciate your time and everything that you're doing.
Many thanks. It's always a great pleasure.
Folks, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate your support. I appreciate you tuning in to the Caris Molecular Minute podcast. Subscribe, rate, review, and share with your friends and colleagues. I look forward to hearing from you at cnabhan@carisls.com. Until next time, take care.